Hello and welcome to AARC Perspectives, where we talk with members of the respiratory care community and learn about their experiences caring for patients and building the profession. I am Doug Lair, Chief Operating Officer at the American Association for Respiratory Care, and I will serve as your host for today's episode. Since 1947, the AARC has been leading the effort to advance the respiratory care profession and promote high-quality, cost-effective, patient-centric respiratory care. The respiratory care profession is ever-growing and evolving thanks to dedicated respiratory therapists around the world. On today's podcast, we have guest Jim Dameron. Jim is a respiratory therapist, professional speaker, and coach who specializes in presenting topics many people run away from, like end-of-life issues, brain death, and especially burnout. Jim works part-time as a respiratory therapist and clinical ethics consultant for Atrium Health in Charlotte, North Carolina, and chairs the Ethics Education Subcommittee. Jim is the author of Smoke Screening, Narratives to Navigate Caregiver Burnout, and has earned 6 degrees, including 3 graduate degrees, which, as he describes, simply means that he's not smart enough to know when to stop studying. Please join me in welcoming our guest, Jim Dameron, to today's podcast. Hey, good afternoon, Jim. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, so this is a really, really important and critical topic that we want to talk about today, and that is healthcare provider burnout and resiliency. I think the two go hand in hand, and you've been identified as a content expert in that area by the association. And so before we really get into the issues and topics of burnout and resiliency, why don't you share with our listeners today just a little bit about yourself, who you are, your career path, and how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, I appreciate it. Yeah, my name is Jim, of course, and I've been in respiratory for 23, coming on 24 years now.
So you're an old timer.
I know. Got the gray hairs to prove that. And really about 3 years ago, after spending all kinds of years in different modes of respiratory with ICU and even some traveling and some skilled nursing, my passion has always been teaching, and I've always tried to incorporate that into the field and everything that I did. So I wanted to try to pursue speaking as a profession, and I just didn't want to speak on any random topic that you just kind of like to talk about. I really wanted to make an impact, and I know that sounds cliche, but I really wanted to make an impact and be as effective as I could at speaking on something that really made a difference. And, you know, burnout actually found me, again, another cliche, because I started digging around and I thought, well, you know, what am I going to talk about? Because, you know, 23 years of pulmonary experience, I have education in medical ethics and theology, you know, it's almost too many options to choose from. So what I did is I started asking colleagues in different disciplines, you know, physicians and nurses and even other instructors, and saying, what is the biggest issue that you're facing or your students facing right now? And without fail, and I'm not exaggerating one bit, but 100% of everybody that I asked said burnout. And I took a step back. I didn't realize how ubiquitous this issue was. I mean, I had gone through it, but I thought, well, that was pretty unique. And, you know, I just happened to be one of those persons that couldn't handle the stress or whatever. So I just burned out, but I didn't think anybody else did, really. And they said, yeah, one instructor, nursing instructor, said, all my students are struggling with this. I said, but they're students. How can they be burning out? I'm not even in the field yet. This is not a good sign. So I started doing the research. I started digging into that topic and really found how detrimental and how much the costs were, not just financially, but emotionally and at an organizational level, et cetera, how much this has really impacted healthcare. And then, you know, from there, I just started speaking and writing and just digging more and more into it.
So that is fascinating. I want to circle back real quick because I'm not sure that I heard you correct. Did you say that you have been or have experienced burnout yourself, or you've not?
You heard that correctly. It was 2 years in, just 2 years into the 22 years, and I just fried. I was just on fire and then just completely smoked out, and I quit. I actually walked away from respiratory because I just couldn't take it anymore. And I took about 6 months off and just didn't do any respiratory whatsoever. I just tutored. And a lot of people say, okay, so what happened is you realized you just loved respiratory and you had to come back to it. And, you know, the rest is history. And the reality, I'd love to say that, I really would. But the reality was I ran out of money because I was teaching students. And, you know, when summer hits, nobody needs any tutoring. So I slowly got back into respiratory, started PRN 1-2 days a week, and then went back up to full time. But it took a while for me to recover. And that's one of the big messages when it comes to burnout is people, you know, a lot of people will experience this. And that is, you know, there's a difference between feeling like I just can't do this today versus I can't do this anymore. One's a bad day. You know, maybe something's going on at home. Maybe it's just a rough day at work and you go, I just can't do this today. We all have those days, but that's a completely different scenario than I just can't do this anymore. I am done. And I felt that. And it was, again, very early on in my career, which I found is pretty common because people that start out in their careers don't have the experience, don't have the competence to know basically themselves, for one, what refuels me, what, you know, drains me, and also the competence level, that confidence that I know what I'm doing and I'm confident in what I'm doing. I just don't have that early on in your career. So all that compounded and just forced me to walk away from it, which I did.
So you said you left the profession for 6 months. Not everybody has the ability to do that. Several of our members, respiratory therapists, have financial obligations to themselves, to their families, to their spouses, to their children. Do you find it commonplace for respiratory therapists or even just healthcare providers in general to vacate the profession when they experience this, or do they just try to, you know, grind through it?
I would go with the latter, and that's a very good point, which is you can still work and be burned out. You know, people think I'm burned out. You're just done. You can't move. You're just lying in the bed in depression. And the reality is you can still function. You can still assess patients. You can still, you know, chart behind a computer screen and you can still manage other people. You won't be as effective and you'll be frustrated and you'll be cynical and all those other things that come along with burnout. And we all know those people who are just kind of be the Debbie Downers you know, our colleagues are in our department and sometimes we are those people, but you can still function. You can still work. It's just that you build up what I call an emotional callus. And I equate it to martial artists and boxers. And it reminds me of Bruce Lee, who back in the day, to toughen up his knuckles, he would punch repeatedly denser and denser objects. He would punch a bag full of sand, then he would go with pebbles, and then he would move up to rocks, etc. So he'd build up these calcium deposits on his knuckles in order to kind of deaden that so he could actually punch and not have that pain. And that's great if you're a combat fighter or a boxer, but it's not good if you're trying to care for other people, because that makes an emotional callousness, and you get to the point where you can't empathize with patients. You just want to clock in, you want to clock out, and you just want to just let me do my checklist. Let me go in, do what I need to do, and let me get out of here. And that just carries so much baggage, and it's contagious, and it affects you and affects everyone around you, especially your patients.
So you had made a comment that you were only 2 years into your career. Some of the conversations that you've had with your nursing colleagues is that their students were experiencing burnout. And I kind of liken that to a young asthmatic child. Mm. They experience shortness of breath, but because they don't know what shortness of breath is or what it feels like, they just think that that's the normal for them.
Yeah.
So for our young professionals just entering into the profession, whether they're a student or maybe just a year or two in, do they even know that that's what they're experiencing? Obviously, they know there's stress associated with work, but for many of them, they might just look at it and say, this is just what comes with the territory. Do they even know that they're experiencing burnout typically?
I think partly no. I mean, obviously it depends on the person, but it's a very good point in that, one, there's a couple of things that stem from that. One, we're not preparing our students well enough. And there's always that adage of, yes, I know that's what you learn in school, but that's not what we do in the real world. I mean, how many times we hear that? I heard a physician say that the other day to some students, to a medical student. Yeah, I know that's what you learned in school, but in the real world. And I thought, can we just stop doing that? Can we just start with, all right, this is what you're going to face. And you know, oftentimes that's some academic understanding, but the reality is sometimes you can't, you don't understand yourself until you experience these stresses. And it's through those stresses, it's through those moments that you realize, you know, who you are, what really affects you, what really triggers you, and what refuels you. And everybody's a little bit different in that. And I think for students, and I love the analogy of an asthmatic, they think, oh, I guess this is the way I'm supposed to feel.
Yes.
And this is
yes.
not good, but it is. And you go, no, actually, this isn't normal. And we can kind of correct that. We can actually change that to a certain extent. And I think that's a lot of times is students come in, and I don't want to just pick on students, but even people early on in their career, they have these expectations. And when those expectations are not met because they've glamorized it, maybe themselves or other people have told them, you know, those guidance counselors, if we could just get a hold of them, you know, and said, you know, hey, here's what you're going to do. You're going to walk in. It's going to be just like a TV show. You're going to walk in and you're going to fix this patient in about 25 minutes. And the whole family is going to come in. They're going to hug you and they're going to want to give you all these prizes. And it's just going to be lovely. And the reality is you're going to get spit on. You're going to get bled on. You're going to come home stinking and it's going to be a long day. And unless we prepare them, at least with the knowledge that this is going to happen, then it's going to be very easy for these new people starting out to go, this is not what I expected. So if it's not what I expected, then either there's something wrong with me, which often is the case. People think it's a resiliency issue, or, you know, they just lied to me, or they didn't tell me the truth. And this is not what I wanted to do. And I'm just going to switch vocations.
So when we look at healthcare, it is built around all of the high risk indicators that you would think of for burnout: long and extended shifts, 24-hour coverage. You're working with really sick people. You're getting, as you said, coughed on, bled on, spit on. Some people are even getting physically assaulted while they're at the hospital.
Mm, yeah.
And then of course the reality of being a healthcare provider is that it can be a very beautiful experience, but you watch people die. And so COVID comes along and you have this pile of, you know, wood in your backyard that is saturated in kerosene already. And all it needs is a spark to blow up. And here comes COVID with their big torch ready to just throw it on that pile of wood. And that's exactly what happened. Can you just speak to that a little bit? I mean, I think we're seeing it that it was becoming more commonplace prior to COVID, and it just blew up completely come last March.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it. I'm going to steal that analogy the next time I talk about it. The spark in it's already coated in kerosene. But yeah, I, to your point, that's exactly what I think happened. You know, burnout's nothing new. It's been around, at least officially, you know, when it's been labeled for 50 years. But what COVID did, I think, is it exposed the fact that RTs, and not just RTs, but most frontline clinicians are dancing on that edge already. They're constantly being stressed. And that's essentially what burnout is a consistent demand that exceeds your resources. So when you constantly get that, again, I go back to that Bruce Lee and Knuckle thing. When you constantly get that, every little bit, not a big deal, but when you compile it together, and the aggregate of it really adds to, and that can just send you over the edge. And it's similar to what, you know, physical therapists and occupational therapists will tell you. You go, what happened to your back? I threw my back out. I don't know what happened. I just lifted a 5-pound box and it was no big deal. They said, no, you lifted the 5-pound box one too many times wrong. And that's kind of what I see in burnout. It's not that it's just this one event, which can happen, by the way. It's really compassion fatigue. You can have a massive traumatic event and burn out. But normally burnout is an accumulation of stressors that happen slowly over time. And when you're already on that edge and then COVID hits and the things that weren't stressors, like getting up, going to work, and then coming home, well, now you have to worry about wearing a mask. Frankly, am I going to get sick? Is today the day that I get sick? Is today the day that I make somebody sick? And now I can't go to the movies to refuel me. I can't go visit some family, or I can't even go out to dinner, for crying out loud. Just something that I take for granted because we've done it so much. When you add all of those stressors and our mind is constantly on alert and that sympathetic nervous system is constantly being used, you know, that fight or flight, then there is a mechanism in our brain that measures how much epinephrine is in there. And when there's too much epi, it starts a quitting mechanism. And you get to the point where you go, I can't do this anymore. I mean, I can't even walk out my front door without thinking, do I have the right mask on? Where am I going to go? Et cetera, where before we didn't have to worry about that. So now the things that we never had to worry about, we have to worry about, which means there's more stressors. And like you said, that's just the one more spark that just lights up the whole pile of wood.
Yeah, I have been hearing horror stories from respiratory managers across the country that if the problem was not already bad enough, hospitals across the country are in desperate need of staffing. Mm-hmm. So they reach out to these travel agencies and pay, you know, and are offering huge dollars.
Yeah.
So then the travel agencies are offering some respiratory therapists I've heard of as much as $100 an hour to quit their job, leave their job and travel across the country to a hospital that's in need. Well, that might fix the problem for the hospital that's willing to pay that money, but the hospital that just had that person
right
quit now creates massive staffing shortages in their own organization or the one that they just left. And so it's just this vicious cycle that it's the survival of the fittest almost.
Yeah.
It's just this horrific, horrific situation. I do want to talk about resiliency, but and I was hoping that you could share with me, and maybe this just organically happens throughout the rest of our conversation, but what is it that makes some people, how do they have that inherent defense mechanism, the ability to bounce back, and others just throw their hands up and say, I quit?
Yeah, it's a wonderful question, and I wish I had the magic bullet and the pill for that. I would be making more than $100 an hour, I can tell you that. Yeah. You know, and I don't blame the people that do that. I mean, hey, who wouldn't take $100 an hour? I mean, frankly, that's amazing. But like you say, it just compounds the problem. It's putting a bandage on a problem that may fix this one over here, but it adds to the problem over here. And yeah, to your point about resiliency, yeah, it is the ability to bounce back. And I like to equate it to, because, you know, we have to do pulmonary illustrations. That's our job. Everything that we say has to have a pulmonary illustration. So I liken it to compliance, and it's your ability of your lungs to kind of recoil. And that's what resilience is. But resilience takes time. And that's why I think a lot of people starting out in their career just don't have that, because it's working through those minor stressors, and minor stressors build that resilience. Because you talk to somebody who, you know, you come in and you have the student or you have the person that's been working a year and hopefully being mentored or at least taught or have as a resource someone who's been doing it for quite some time. And they go, I just lost a patient today. And you go, yeah, I remember the first time I lost a patient. How'd you get through it? Here's how I got through it. And it's that ability, one, to talk about it, because if you don't talk it out, you're going to act it out in some way. When you have someone there to bounce these ideas off of that have been there and done that, have that t-shirt, if you will, then you know how to get through that. Even if it's just by seeing someone going, well, they got through it. So they build up that resiliency over time. But some people just have a knack, and it might be, you know, the worldview. There's so many things that come into play. You know, when everybody's worldview comes into play, and if you know what you believe and why you believe it, that really helps your identity. It helps you look in the future, et cetera. Everybody has their own different way of a coping mechanism, and everybody's a little bit different. So there isn't a one size fits all. It's just knowing yourself, which again, usually takes time. It usually takes those situations of stress and trauma. You can't prepare for that. You can't sit down in a classroom and say, well, when I go through the loss of a patient, here's what you need to do. Here's step one. Here's bullet point one. And here's your PowerPoint slide. And here's how you get through it. Okay. You can't teach that because I don't know how you're going to react. And I didn't know how I reacted when I lost my first patient, and then the second, and then the third. And then over time, what helped me was actually writing it out, and actually literally writing it out, not just talking about it. And it was writing it out and reflecting on things that I hadn't realized that I hadn't dealt with years after the fact. Then the significance of it, the impact of it became clear. And that's what really helped me get through and helped me build more resilience.
You'd indicated journaling. I agree wholeheartedly. I know that in many facets of life, whether it's dealing with grief or self-doubt or depression, journaling is a very effective mechanism. But you said something that I think is very, very important, and that is being able to talk about your feelings and be able to share those experiences with your coworkers. I don't know if you've ever read the book Crucial Conversations, but there is a concept in Crucial Conversations that it talks about silence versus violence, that if you don't talk about those feelings that you have, then there's going to be an outburst in some way. Mm-hmm. And I liken it to burnout and resiliency, and the fact that if you don't talk about the feelings that are leading to burnout, it is going to lead to some poor outcome. And so I think that talking and sharing your experiences and your feelings with your coworkers is extremely important.
Yeah, and it's like a safety valve. I got to use the pulmonary illustration again. You know, it's like a safety valve. You have, when you get to a certain amount of pressure, it's going to be released. Well, if you don't release that, if you didn't have a safety valve on that tank, it's going to explode at some point. So if you can't, and that's kind of what talking it out, even writing it out, because some people just don't have the resource to talk it out with someone. They don't have the spouse, they don't have the family, the friend to be able to do that, or they just don't feel comfortable. I always say, hey, you know, you can talk to a perfect stranger. You can talk to counselors, and a lot of hospitals and organizations have employee assistance programs that have counseling as part of that. And they usually give you, I guess it depends on the organization, some free sessions with that, but even a peer group. And just to say, you know what, I just want to vent. And I used to have that when I was managing, is I would have an open door policy. If you just needed to vent, you didn't want me to respond. You just needed to come in the door,
right,
shut the door, and you just wanted to vomit whatever it is that was going. And it might have something to do with something that's going on at home. And I let it be that if you just want to come in and just spew all of this anger, frustration, whatever it is, I'm here. I won't judge it. I'll just sit, be quiet, and listen to you. And if you want me to respond, which 99% of the time they didn't, they just wanted to get it out. And those people are usually the healthiest people, because they get it out. And by getting it out, you actually process it. And even those people that think they're internal processors, which I am primarily, there is something about getting it out, saying it out, or writing it out that helps you process and helps you get through those moments where it's confusing and you just don't know what to do, or it's just so therapeutic to get it out, like you say. And it's a great book, by the way.
Yeah. Do you find that women or females have a greater ability to bounce back and incorporate resiliency efforts than men do? Because I see a lot of men that are, they just go into denial about it, that, oh, I don't need that. I don't need to talk about my feelings. I just need to punch that bag full of rice or that gravel like Bruce Lee. and I'll get through it. I just need to suck it up. Do you find that there's any more successes in from a gender standpoint as it relates to the ability to bounce back and be resilient?
Well, let's just be honest here. Women are just so much tougher than men anyway in so many different ways. Let's just be honest. Anybody who's stuck, anybody with an ABG, know that most men scream and whine, and most women just say, eh. So just physical pain, emotional pain. Women are by and large, I wouldn't even say by and large, overwhelmingly tougher than men. That said, I don't know of any research that specifically has shown that men have burned out more than women, et cetera. Just maybe in healthcare, there's, you know, for, I know there's physicians that there's an overwhelming link at those physicians who have burned out and have been suicidal, because there's been a lot of studies on physician suicide. And a lot of it has, they've discerned, is that there's a stigma associated with, especially for men. So I agree with you to a certain extent, that there's a stigma associated with anything revolving around mental health. Mm-hmm. And sometimes burnout and talking about what's going on, that's a mental health thing. I don't have a mental health thing. I'm just going to go punch a bag, which frankly does help sometimes.
Yes.
I mean, hey, punching a heavy bag is so therapeutic. So there is that element to it. And when it's stigmatized, you tend to just suppress it. But again, it'll come out in some other way. And you don't want it to come out in a depression, because you don't want it to spiral down to the point where you just say, you know what, this isn't worth it, because no one should ever feel like life is not worth living. And, you know, your world isn't revolving around respiratory. As important as it is, as important as your job and your vocation is, there's more to your life than your work. But often we find our identity in what we do.
Yes, yes, yes.
And solely in what we do. And there's nothing wrong with finding your identity in what you do. But when you solely look at that, then if anything happens to that, your expectations are not met, then you think, well, that's it. Then I'm burned out. I can't do this anymore. Then what's the point of living? But overwhelmingly, I think women do have an easier time getting in touch with their emotions. One of it being the stigma. Stigma usually isn't there. But there is still a stigma when you get to the higher levels, which when you get to physicians and places of leadership, you know, you feel like I have to do this. You know, my job is to care for others. And we can kind of take that on as ourselves as caregivers. My job is to care for you. And we can rationalize all of these weird feelings and burnout. You know, I don't have time to deal with this frustration and these feelings because I got to care for somebody else. I'm the caregiver. And often what it takes is just someone to give you permission to do that. And it might just be a word. What's going on? How is your day today? What happened today? And sometimes that's all it takes to say, you know what? I actually had a tough day. And that sometimes is all it takes.
Yeah. What about mindfulness and meditation? So last year, last fall, when the AARC took Congress virtual, we tried to recognize that there were people who were struggling. Many of our members and attendees of the event were struggling. And we knew that that taking out that human face-to-face interaction that naturally and organically happens at our live events was no longer there. We tried to recognize some of these things, and we incorporated some mindfulness and meditation exercises at the beginning of each day, and I think one over lunch. And I participated in one of those sessions. I didn't feel that I was suffering from burnout. I am a respiratory therapist, but I cannot speak to the challenges that our members are going through themselves. I don't work in hospital anymore. But I did a meditation exercise for 10 minutes, and I fully committed to it. And 10 minutes later, I felt like a whole new person. Is there a place for mindfulness and meditation for those who need to be more resilient?
Absolutely. And there's tons of research behind this. And mindfulness is talk about nothing new. And this has been around for thousands of years. And meditation is just mindfulness actually incorporates the meditation, which is just focused thinking and my question to that is, you know, what are you focusing on? Because a lot of times they'll say, you know, don't focus on it, focus on nothing. And, you know, I'm the guy in the back that raises his hand and says, excuse me, you can't focus on nothing. Nothing by definition philosophically is no existence. Let's, you know, what are you focusing on? And often, which I find very helpful, is your breathing. Well, focus on your breathing. And I actually did an experiment when I was working. I was actually working with a physician in when I was getting care. And it's a whole nother tangent. It's a whole nother podcast there. But the physician said, you know, I want to work on this meditation for you and see what that does. And that actually hooked me up with probes. And they had students coming in, taking notes. And I said, boy, this is a whole big thing here. And I went through, 10 weeks of focused meditation, mindfulness training, and to see what it would do. And I, of course, volunteered to say, let's just see what it do. And at the end of the day, or at the end of the study, the doctor said, you know what, you are very good at chilling out. Okay, thank you so much. And it didn't take but 10, 20 seconds at the end. And initially, it took minutes and minutes for me just to chill out, calm myself down. And then at the end, I was able to just flip a switch, which comes in extremely handy when you're facing that stressful moment, because it doesn't take but sometimes a few seconds. That's why people say, stop, breathe, just take a deep breath in and breathe. And you go, okay, this is ridiculous. No, actually, physiologically, you're shifting your body from the sympathetic to the parasympathetic. And often it only takes a few seconds to do that, to buffer that enough to where you can continue to move forward. And meditation, whether you're praying, whether you're just focused on breathing, whatever you're doing, shifts you from that sympathetic to that parasympathetic. And when you're calm and those cortisol levels balance out and those neuromodulators like serotonin, which and oxytocin, all those things that help with your well-being, it is almost like a drug. And like you say,
yeah,
you said, man, I just feel like a new person. And you go, well, it's because we never do this. You know, we go to work, we're stressed, we come home. How was it? Oh, it was awful. You know, people, so-and-so did this. Then we watch something horrible on TV that has violence and crime. And then we just turn it off and go to bed. And you go, geez, I had these horrible dreams. I have no idea why. And if you just spent 5 minutes or even 10 minutes ago and you know what, let me just stop. Even if it's just writing something, focusing on something, breathing, praying, whatever it is, and shift your body into that rest and digest mode, it's amazing how quickly your body will recover and balance that out.
Yeah, I think maybe Apple might be onto something with their Apple Watches where, once an hour, they have you take 10 deep breaths because they know that there's health benefits. So, Jim, I have two more questions, and we are starting to run close to the end of our podcast today. But resiliency, as defined by some people, is nothing more than a Band-Aid if you can't address the systemic problem of burnout, because you'll put that Band-Aid on, the bleeding will stop or diminish, and then you take the Band-Aid off, and then it's just this big vicious cycle. From a resiliency standpoint, are there recommendations that you have for our listeners today on how to address or deal with that systemic issue of burnout?
Yeah, that's a very good point, because resiliency, yeah, you're not treating the problem. And burnout, let's face it, is not the problem. Burnout is a symptom, and that's by definition. The World Health Organization in 2019, you know, officially recognized burnout as an occupational phenomenon. It's a syndrome. It's a collection of symptoms. And what I often say is, you know, no one comes into the ER complaining of a heart attack. They come in complaining of chest pain, shortness of breath, digestive issues, et cetera. But the reality is the problem is they're having a heart attack. Well, burnout is a symptom of something deeper. So what's really going on? And it's not necessarily a question of resilience. And I don't like when people say, well, the reason why you're burning out is you're not resilient enough. Because I think that's misleading. And it's not because the RT isn't strong enough, because that gives you the impression that, well, you need to be tougher. You know, toughen up, man. Just toughen up. And it's not necessarily a question of resilience. It could be incorporated with that. But the reality is there's something going on whether it is expectations, maybe something physiologically for me, that there was a, that was a huge component for me. There was a physiological issue that my body couldn't handle the stress. My adrenals had shut down. I just didn't realize it. And I had no tolerance. And all of a sudden I went from this tolerance of I can handle anything to, you know, dropping a pen and I would flip out and you go, geez, what is this guy's problem? And so resiliency isn't necessarily the issue. Yeah, it can put a Band-Aid, but you're still bleeding. So we have to get to the problem and what's causing the burnout. And I like to put stressors into two main categories, life situation or lifestyle. And by and large, we can't control life situation stressors. You know, the pandemic, I can't control that. I can't control politics. I can't control, although I'd like to, I can't control other people's opinion besides putting fingers in my ear and ignoring that. But I can't control lifestyle. So you can control your diet. You can control your exercise. You can control how you react and respond to certain stressors. So I like to kind of categorize the stressors. Is this a lifestyle or is this a life situation? And if it's a life situation, I basically put up my hands and go, there's nothing I can do about this. So you have to let it go. You know, insert Frozen theme here. Just let it go because there's nothing I can do about it. As much as I can't stand, you know, the city council or the federal government or what, there's nothing I can do about it short of calling my representative and saying, here's my opinion, and voting. That's to the extent of really what I can do. So you have to let it go. Easier said than done. But I can control the life situation or the lifestyle things. Am I doing what I can do to mitigate these stressors and how it affects me? Am I doing my meditation? If this particular thing over here is stressing me out, am I doing something to counteract that? Am I breathing? Am I setting the proper boundary for me and leaving work at work and leaving the stresses there and not bringing them home? Am I putting things in place that will mitigate me ever getting to the point where I am just on the edge? And that's especially important when you're in a major worldwide pandemic where the things that you normally could rely on, like travel and visiting, aren't there. Then you need to find other resources to counteract that.
So we have about two or three more minutes left, and I'm going to ask you the money question. It's the question I think everybody is stuck around to the end of this podcast for. If one of our listeners is suffering from burnout, if you could provide them with three bullet points, three things that they could do to immediately start making an impact on their life, potentially addressing the burnout, which is a symptom of a much bigger issue, but from a resiliency standpoint, what would those top three things be?
Yeah, my top three revolve around an acronym of PPE. So we know we have to don our PPE. And the first thing I would say is, first of all, if you're burned out or if you feel like you're burning out, there's hope. So it's treatable and it's recoverable, but it takes time. You didn't burn out overnight, so you're not going to take that magic pill. It's not that you're going to go on vacation. I mean, how many times have we said, I can't wait for vacation, we go on vacation, and the second we clock back in and come into work, it seems like it's all gone. It's because it didn't happen overnight. So you're not going to recover usually overnight. But just like a broad spectrum antibiotics, until you uncover the real problem of the infection, we give broad spectrum antibiotics to kind of mitigate that infection. And then once the blood sample or sputum sample comes back, then we can target that with a specific antibiotic. Well, I think the same thing holds true for us, where until you can uncover what's really causing the burnout, which is normally not one thing, there are things you can do to kind of mitigate that. And I like going back to what I said before about focusing on the first P is the person in the room. You have to focus on yourself. That's self-care. And that's doing some of the meditation, some of the, you know, my favorite is just stopping for a few seconds, taking those deep breaths in, you know, whenever I'm faced with a situation that I need to just stop, take a moment. And sometimes it's 5 seconds, sometimes it's 10 seconds. But focusing on the P, the person in the room, which I learned through counseling and coaching training, which is there are things that are outside of your control. As much as that drives us crazy, we're not the center of the universe. You have to let some of those things go that you can't control. What can you control? Focus on that. That's the person in the room. The second is the, I call the punchline. That's my favorite thing in the world, which is finding something that really cracks me up. I mean, not something that is, that's funny. That's kind of cute. You chuckle, but when's the last time that you just laughed uncontrollably? And what, I mean, they say laughter is the best medicine. Well, it often is. I mean, it's the physiological benefits of laughter are amazing. And I won't go into all the details, but it balances your immune system and it balances your cortisol levels, all kinds of things. So I find something, whether it be a stand-up comedian or a show or a movie that I know is going to crack me up. And I try to do that at least before I go to bed. Because if you can laugh before you go to bed, one, it'll help you sleep better. And frankly, who doesn't need better quality sleep? So that's the second P. And the last one is empathy. And a lot of people don't like this one because it takes time and it's one of those things where you go, how do I just do this? And it is almost counterintuitive. It's showing compassion to someone else helps you realize the other person's shoes and or realize what the other person is thinking. And if you think about the top Pixar movies of all time, and you think of Toy Story and A Bug's Life and Cars, etc., all those movies made billions of dollars focusing on something from the other's perspective, the perspective of a bug, the perspective of a toy, the perspective of a car, etc. I ask myself, okay, so let's say I'm going into a room and I know it's not going to be good. And it's just a horrible situation, et cetera. Stop, take a few deep breaths, walk in, and I try to think of what's going on from the patient's perspective or the family's perspective. And I try to do that when I do ethics consultations as well. What are they thinking? How are they viewing me? And the more compassion that you show, the more you, and compassion is something that, not something that you just get. It's something that you develop. If you can just show a little compassion, that actually helps you. It benefits you, not just the patient and or the family member. It benefits you. So when the more times that you do that, people think, well, I'm going to open myself up to more burnout when I show more compassion, et cetera. Actually, it does the opposite. When you show more compassion, you develop and you foster more that empathetic skill, if you will, in your brain, which is on short supply when we can't interact with other people. That actually counteracts burnout. It counteracts those effects that we feel, all of those things. And when you do that PPE, I think that is a huge, for me, that's my PPE. That's what I don. Every time that I go into work, I think about those three things. How can I incorporate that? And that's kind of my broad spectrum treatment protection moving forward.
That is great advice. So Jim, we are coming up at the end of the podcast, before I let you go, I will ask, is there a question that I should have asked, but I did not?
Ooh, throwing it back on me. I think you really covered everything. And the only thing I would leave with, and I would reiterate, is don't get distraught and don't feel like this is a failure on your part. There's an individual responsibility, of course, with burnout, but there's also an organizational responsibility too. You know, we need to try to create this culture of valuing RTs. And that's a whole other podcast there as well. But don't feel like this is untreatable. You can get through this. You can protect yourself. It may not be 100% preventable, but you can get through it. And if and when you get through it, you'll be much stronger, much more resilient on the other side. Just give it some time.
Jim Dameron, thank you so much. These last 40, 45 minutes have been fascinating. I know they were for me. I'm sure they will be for our listeners as well. I do know that it is likely some of our listeners out there are struggling with burnout. They're struggling with resiliency strategies. If somebody wants to reach out to you for further follow-up or just to chat about this, what is the best way for our listeners to get in touch with you?
A couple of ways. You can go to the website. I have a website called jimdameron.com, or you can just check me out on LinkedIn and connect with me there. I'd be happy to talk with you guys and, you know, even go do some one-on-one. That's helped me more than anything, is working one-on-one with somebody.
Great. Jim, this was a fantastic podcast. I really, really enjoyed it. I hope you did as well. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. And it was a pleasure being here.
You got it. All right. You take care.
Thanks for listening to AARC Perspectives. Be sure to check out our show notes page for information about today's episode, as well as links to our other podcast episodes. Be sure to know when our next episode airs by subscribing to our podcast. Until next time, my friends, keep on supporting the respiratory therapy profession.